Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to be talking with Amy Bowers-Cordalis about her new book, The Water Remembers, My Indigenous Family's Fight to Save a River and a Way of Life. For the members of the Yurok tribe in California, the Klamath River and its salmon are the lifeblood of the people, a vital source of food, income, and cultural identity. When a catastrophic fish kill devastates the river, Amy Bowers-Cordalis, a Yurok tribal member, is propelled into action, reigniting her family's 170-year battle against the U.S. government. Amy Bowers-Cordalis is a mother, fisherwoman, attorney, and member and former general counsel of the Yurok tribe, formerly a staff attorney at the Native American Rights Fund. She is currently co-founder and co-director of the Ridges to Riffles Conservation Indigenous Group. She's also the recipient of the UN's highest environmental honor, Champion of the World Laureate, among other honors. Amy Bowers-Cordalis, such a pleasure to welcome you to Access Utah. Thank you.
Ayakui, waklau. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. So, fascinating book. This is your family's history, you know, history writ large, but also your family's history. So we'll get into that. I want to set the scene, though. Tell me about your ancestral village. It's the mouth of the Klamath River there. Tell me about the village today and then the way it was maybe in your great-grandmother's time.
Yeah, thank you for the question. So I am from the village of Rekwoy at the mouth of the Klamath River, right where the river meets the Pacific Ocean in what is now called Northern California. It's right in the heart of Yurok country and on the most, I guess you would call that, northwestern tip of the Yurok Reservation. And Rekwoy is a powerful, beautiful, remarkable place. My family's been there since the beginning of time. We were never relocated during colonization. And so, you know, we've developed this deep relationship with the dirt of that land. I always like to say I am literally from the dirt of this place. but of course also have developed a deep relationship with the river and the salmon. And my family has been fishing for the same runs of Klamath salmon since the beginning of time. And one thing my dad always kind of jokes about is that at this point, the fish and our family have the same or similar DNA because we've been coexisting for so long. The place itself is a very powerful ecosystem in itself. You know, it's where Rekwoy means where the river ends in Yurok. And so it's a place where the mouth of the river is at the estuary. And so the combination of, you know, a roaring, big, massive Pacific Ocean with the big estuary and the interchange of, you know, fresh water and salt water is just a really powerful place. It's also surrounded by redwoods, some of the oldest, you know, trees on the whole planet. And so it's a very powerful place. It is a very wet place, I would say. There's water in different forms, whether it be ocean water, you know, in the salt water or the fresh water in the river, or dew or rain or fog or mist, you know, sort of water in all its various forms surrounds us. And it has remained, for the most part, largely unchanged. It was one of Yurok's most popular villages in Aboriginal times. And my family and many of the other Yurok families that have occupied it since the beginning of time have stayed there. And it's a very, that part of the world is pretty remote still. And so there hasn't been a lot of development. And so one of the things that I always kind of daydreamed about as a kiddo growing up fishing in the estuary that sits just below the village is how I could look up at the village and see a very similar scene as what I imagine my ancestors would have seen at nighttime. You know, just little fires coming from the redwood plank houses, which of course now are just, you know, little teeny lights. There aren't street lights, you know, so just the occasional house light. And so we get to see something that's very similar to what my ancestors saw. So I feel really, lucky to maintain and to have been able to have been raised in that place where my ancestors have been since the beginning of time.
Yeah, it sounds beautiful. Before we jump into the history, tell me about the salmon. I mean, we you know, I know a bit about salmon, right? Not as much, I'm sure, as you know, but the fact they swim upstream, quite a ways upstream. In fact, we're jumping ahead a bit, but after the removal of the dams, 300 river miles, salmon have been found now, right? To go to spawn, I guess.
We're this year is the second year that the adult salmon have enjoyed a free river, and I mean, spoiler alert of the whole book, right? Like the river remembers, or the water remembers, the river remembers, the salmon remember, because I'll tell you what, we removed those dams and the river started to instantly heal. The salmon almost instantly, 7 days later after removing the furthest, the lowest dam, the salmon came home and went past the dams, which had blocked their passage for over 100 years. And this year they have come back in even stronger force. We're just about getting the numbers for this year, but it looks like it's going to be close to about 10,000 salmon have gone past the former dam sites, which is 30% more than last year. And also, they went further this year than they went last year. They're, as you were commenting, like way above the former dam sites up into Oregon, into historical spawning grounds they hadn't been in, 100 or so years. So it's very remarkable, really special.
Wanted to get into this long, long fight with, your people with the U.S. government. I guess it probably, the first white settlers come and the fight begins. Gold rush times really intensified that, right? And it's the old story, a conflict over land and different ways of life.
That's exactly right. So Yurok's Aboriginal territory spanned from what is now the far northern coastal corner of California, and then up into what we call our high country, which is the first kind of coastal Cascade, Klamath, mountain range. And that area is rich with, what non-Indians called resources. Gold, redwoods, other kind of big coniferous trees. The river itself, it historically was the third largest salmon producing river in all the lower United States. So, really just things that could make a profit, right? And what that meant, sadly, was that there was a long period of colonization, and it started with genocide. We have, well, it's a long story, and I tried to tell it quickly in the book, but while also giving it justice, because and maybe I will write more books about some of the more specific stories in there, but every generation of my family has fought for the health of the Klamath River, for the health of our salmon, and for the survival of our people and our fishing-based way of life. And that did start kind of around the gold rush. More non-Indians were coming into the territory, and there was a treaty negotiated in 1851 that the Senate refused to sign, in part because the state of California called the then Secretary of Interior and said, we are in the business, and they didn't use these words, but essentially the message was, we're in the business of terminating Indians and reserving Indian land. And creating a place for their future is not in our interest. And that was true. So by 1910, about 90% of California's indigenous population had been slaughtered. There were state laws that basically put a monetary value on Indian heads and then sent our children either into forced labor or boarding schools. And so my family was in that very small 10% that remained alive, and also an even smaller percentage that was able to remain on their homelands. And so we were really lucky, but we really had to fight for that. And that's what I tried to put in the second part of the book, was that historical fight where essentially every generation responded to their circumstances at hand. So when the treaty failed, the Yurok Reservation was created in 1855 through 1892 in a series of executive orders that eventually led to the creation of the Yurok Reservation, a mile on either side of the Klamath River from my village up 45 miles. And that helped, we were able to maintain our villages on the river, but we lost our villages along the coast, and then some of them, like the sacred sites, the sacred territory up in the high country. But we thought that, and I talked to elders in the process of writing this book to try to put together how the people felt when all this was happening, right? And then I had also grown up hearing stories about the family's fight through this time. And I wanted to give my readers a different perspective, right? A perspective of like what the Indian people felt as they were going through all these traumatic events and just trying to stay alive. But what I'll tell you is what I found was that there was almost this like radical fight, radical joy, radical like bravery, and this fierceness of it didn't matter what was happening around them and what the state of California, what the federal government said. What they did was what they knew, which was a fishing-based way of life based on the salmon runs, the sturgeon runs, the steelhead, the Yulican, within the Klamath River. And so they just kept fishing against all odds. And, it wasn't like fishing like we know it today or like many people experience it. It really was a way of life where their whole, what everything they did revolved around the river and preparing for fishing, or even in religious ceremonies, praying for that abundance and the health of the river. So just remarkable stories. By 1933, the state of California passed a law that prohibited all Yurok fishing from or on the Klamath River within the Yurok Reservation. And my great uncle Ray was arrested 19 times by the state of California just for fishing in his own home waters, in front of land that his family had reserved, and had been given a land patent to on the Yurok Reservation. It was clearly his land under federal law and his right to do so under his reserved Indian rights, but the state didn't believe him. And his last arrest led to a Supreme Court case, Matz versus Arnett, that reaffirmed that the Yurok Reservation was still Indian country and that the family did indeed have federally reserved rights to fish and to be on the land and the water. And I could keep going because that wasn't it, right? Like it didn't even
Right.
end at that. So, yeah.
I want to pause on that Supreme Court case. This is quite the heritage in your family. So your great uncle, right?
Yeah.
And so the original the first rulings went against your people, right? And against your uncle. In fact, saying that an 1892 act had terminated the reservation's identity as Indian country. So this was a landmark case when the Supreme Court finally ruled in favor of your great uncle, right?
It indeed was landmark. So the state of California's argument was that an 1892 act that applied the General Allotment Act to the Yurok Reservation, which basically opened up the Yurok Reservation to non-Indian ownership. And what that meant practically for the Yurok Reservation, which was rich in timber, was that timber companies came in and bought up the land. And so the state of California argued that that terminated the land as an Indian reservation. And we lost in it started out in the state of California's court. So we lost in the district court and in the appellate court. And we weren't surprised, frankly, because at that time, and this was the late 1960s, State courts, frankly, were hostile to Indian issues. And so it was common for Indian legal rights and Indian cases to rule against the Indians in those state courts. And at that point, actually, the Supreme Court had a very different structure and had a more, well, I'm not going to call it liberal because it wasn't liberal, but it was a different makeup of a court. And so there actually was a strategy where Indian law advocates would try to push cases up to the Supreme Court because the Supreme Court had a much better handle on Indian law issues, which were based in federal law. And a part of the problem was that those state court judges weren't familiar with that federal law. And so we fared better in Supreme Court, and that's what happened. And what's really cool too is that Justice Blackham wrote the majority opinion, or wrote the opinion in Matz versus Arnett, and he had a habit of picking one Indian law case for each session and conducting extensive historical research on that particular case. And he picked Matz versus Arnett, and so he dived deep into the record and discovered that, Uncle Ray had been arrested 19 times, just for fishing on his home waters within the Yurok Reservation. And then Justice Blackmun went into a deep legislative history, a legal history of how the Yurok Reservation was created, compared that with the 1892 Act, the General Allotment Act, and concluded that there was no congressional intent in any of those histories that suggested Congress intended to terminate the Yurok Reservation. And then also said, because the Matz family stayed on the land and kept fishing, the land itself had maintained its Indian character. And that was a primary factor for the court's holding that it was still Indian country. So it's kind of funny because there's that old saying that what, 90% of the law is possession. And in some ways, my family used that to our advantage in this case because we just stayed on the land and kept fishing. And we did that out of just necessity. That was our way of life. We had no other way of feeding ourselves. So we were just trying to survive and be Yurok people, but it worked in our favor.
If you just joined us, we are talking with Amy Bowers Cordalis. She has a new book out, fascinating book. It's called The Water Remembers: My Indigenous Family's Fight to Save a River and a Way of Life. And we're going to take a brief break. We'll be back shortly. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we're talking with Amy Bowers Cordalis. Her new book is called The Water Remembers: My Indigenous Family's Fight to Save a River and a Way of Life. It's out and available now. Amy Bowers Cordalis, you talk about a lot of fascinating characters, real life people in the book. Really, Geneva Matz stands out to me. I think to many she would just a force of life. All right, this is your great grandmother. Tell me a bit about her.
Oh, she was remarkable. So, and thank you for the question. She was born in 1904, and I write about much of her life in the book because it was so remarkable. And she really was a freedom fighter, a cultural bearer, and one of the bravest people I have ever heard of. She was raised by her grandparents. Her father passed away, actually while training to be a medicine man. And in Yurok culture, when that happens, you have to marry the family's sort of next of kin. And so that happened, and the mother went away, but Geneva stayed in Rekwoy with her grandparents. And so she grew up in a redwood plank house, speaking Yurok, living a subsistence-based fishing and gathering way of life. And that served her very well, in part because She knew exactly what Yurok Aboriginal life was like, and she lived that up until about probably 1913, 1915, when she was about to start her own training to be a medicine woman, but was instead forcefully taken away to boarding school up in Chemawa, which is in Salem, Oregon. And remarkably, she learned a lot there and then returned to the reservation and met her to soon be husband, who was a Talawa man, who was the grandson of the last chief of the one of the Talawa bands. His name was Captain Tom. And they got married and lived in Requa, and then also lived up at what we call the home place, which was a family allotment land that was next to Brooks Riffle, which was named after her great grandfather or her grandfather who raised her. And so she continued to basically live a Yurok fishing, hunting, gathering, praying way of life throughout her whole life. And why that was so important was because she then taught my grandma, who then taught my dad, who then taught me. And so there's this clear line of passing down cultural knowledge, religious practices, fishing practices, even the way we eat. Right? The first foods that we eat, seaweed, acorns, deer, elk, salmon, sturgeon, all the things. And I tried to talk about some of those in the book, like napes and salmon cheeks are Yurok delicacies, which people probably don't think are the best cuts of salmon, but those are things that we love. And we know that we learned that through the way that great grandma cooked, right? And so she was just this remarkable human, and she was extremely smart and strategic. She basically ran, what would be the Yurok tribe from her couch, wherever that was, whether it was at the home place up the river or Rekwai. And she led strategic movements for protecting Yurok rights. And I think that's in part how Uncle Ray ended up being, arrested 19 times, right? For just for fishing, because through her leadership, she knew that we had to continue to stay on the land, to stay on the water, and to fight for our Aboriginal rights, which her, ancestors, my ancestors, had reserved. And she felt strongly about that. And not only did she use the law to do that through civil arrest, through sort of protests and fishing, but also through what we called and what I refer to in the book as her Indian way. She strongly believed in the power of prayer, the power of the creator, the power of her sort of worldview, and which was very much Yurok, and which was very much spiritually informed. There's a strong belief that if you lived a good life, if you were good to others, if you interacted with the natural environment in a good way and helped to keep balance on earth, that good things would happen to you. And she frequently went to pray at Orego's, which I talk about a lot in the book, which is a sacred site at the mouth of the river that's in the shape of a Yurok woman with a baby on her basket. And I tell Orego's story, creation story, and the role of Orego's in the beginning of the book, because great grandma frequently, and members of my family still go to Orego's to pray, to ask for things, ask for protection. And Orego's has blessed us with that protection at many points in our life. But Geneva believes strongly in that, and in many ways, her beliefs is what has carried us through this fight all these years. And I mean, as I'm thinking, like, there's so many parts of the book too where her belief in Indian way changed the course of history. Whether it was when she was doing a protest against the federal moratorium of on all Yurok fishing, and she's out there in a little boat doing what we called a fish-in with a gill net in the water when she wasn't supposed to have one, and my grandma's with her, and the federal marshals come out with full riot gear and machine guns, and they get into a tug of war over the net, and it's getting dangerous. And she stands up and starts singing an Indian song, and birds start moving around the boats and gathering more and more and more and squawking and squawking and, essentially protecting her and my grandma and telling what we called the goon squad, the federal marshals, to get the heck away. And then eventually they left. They were so scared. And I write about this in the book. And I conclude there that, it wasn't the Supreme Court that ultimately saved our fishing rights and our way of life. It was really her, and her legacy. And then, of course, like for me personally, this is sort of how the whole story started for me in the fight to undam the Klamath was after witnessing the fish kill, which you spoke about at the beginning of the session here. I really felt her just sort of moving through me. And it was like she propelled me into the fight and told me, it's your turn now, go. And my next thought was, I'm going to go to law school and try to prevent this from ever happening again. And I attribute that to her. So she just was such a remarkable person. And the other thing I'll say is she was very petite. She was about 4'9, and she was extremely effective and articulate. She always went to the sort of top of the line in the chain of command. If she had an issue, she would go straight to the boss and she would figure it out. And she just was a very powerful, powerful person.
Yeah, fascinating, fascinating. Great, great to be descended from her, I imagine.
So lucky.
So you mentioned you felt like your great grandmother, who we were just talking about, came to you. Her influence said, "Hey, you need to join the fight. You need to get educated to go to law school." I wonder about that. A lot of your classmates, I'm sure, in law school are in it for the money or in it for the, I don't know what else. You're in it for your people's cause. Is that, I don't know, did you feel the extra pressure in law school?
I felt a lot of things in law school. Less than 1% of the legal population is Native American. And, you can imagine it's an even smaller percentage that is, a woman Native American. And so I'll admit that I never wanted to go to law school until that moment on the boat and seeing, the dead fish and observing the just extreme level of ecological collapse and crisis. That there were about 70,000 salmon that died along the Klamath River. And by the end of it, their bodies were layering the banks of the river 3, 4 layers deep and just rotting. And it smelled like a war zone. And, for Yurok, you had asked earlier about salmon. The Yurok word for salmon is napui, which means that which is eaten. And I think that's important to note because that's how important the salmon are to us. It is literally that which is eaten. Everything we do revolves around salmon. And we have a myth in Yurok that says if the Klamath salmon go, so too will the Yurok people because there will be no more point for us on Earth. And so witnessing those salmon die felt like I was witnessing the end of my people. And I grew up hearing the historical battles of my family, and I knew how hard they had fought. And naively, this was 2002, I sort of thought those battles were over, right? Like we've evolved as humanity to a point where we don't harm, I don't know, so grossly mismanage natural resources or harm people so deeply. And obviously I was wrong, because the Euro, or excuse me, the fish kill really was an act of ecocide against the people of the Yurok people. And so I just felt that there's just this, sort of after that realization, there was this deep sense of injustice, and also like, what am I going to do? I'm a Yurok girl whose family has been the target of these, genocidal assimilation policies of the federal government for the last 500 years. Like, how am I going to make a difference? And I guess naively, I thought that if I went to law school, I would put myself in a position where at least I could, if my tribe allowed, give them another lawyer, a lawyer who could help interpret laws, who could try to uplift their rights, who could be a part of the overall effort to save the river, access to justice, basically. And so that's what I went and did. And there were thousands of other people who were motivated by the fish kill, a whole generation of other indigenous peoples from the Klamath, but then also a lot of other, kindred souls who were just devastated by the fish kill and devoted their lives to healing it, and so for me, being in law school, that's why I was there. And it really was a way to bring justice to my people. It was a way that I thought I could engage in the highest level of the fight to save my people. And so I didn't really have the privilege of taking it lighthearted. I studied a lot. I was a total dork, but I learned everything I could. I soaked it all up. And I had a lot of wonderful teachers along the way that encouraged me. I got very deeply involved in the Native Law Students Association, and that gave me a great source of support and community. And it was very different. But also, it was one of the greatest privileges of my life to even have access to education at that level.
Let's take another break, come back for the last segment with Amy Bowers-Cordalis. We're talking about her new book, The Water Remembers, My Indigenous Family's Fight to Save a River and a Way of Life. And we'll have more following this brief break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Amy Bowers-Cordalis. She is a mother, fisherwoman, attorney, member, and former general counsel of the Yurok tribe. Formerly a staff attorney with the Native American Rights Fund, she's currently co-founder and co-director of the Ridges to Riffles Conservation Indigenous Group. She's also, among other honors, recipient of the UN's highest environmental honor, Champion of the World Laureate. And her new book is called The Water Remembers, My Indigenous Family's Fight to Save a River and a Way of Life. So you've got dams on the Klamath River. That's been a contributing factor to this big, huge fish kill, fish die-off in 2002, which was a galvanizing event. Also agricultural runoff and some other factors. Tell me a bit about the movement that then accelerated. One little fact I just want to put out here that really impressed me. There would be Native peoples who would follow Pacific Corp around. Right, who operated the dams, including a meeting in Scotland. Just follow Pacific Corp around and just be a thorn in their side. That was one factor. I mean, many factors here. Tell me about this movement.
The movement was fierce, and it was based in ceremony, grassroots activism, law, politics, leadership, and culture. And it was multifaceted, and it was born of the Klamath River from the Klamath indigenous peoples. After the fish kill, we were in a state of existential crisis. And so there were a lot of things that came from that. One was there was a very organized, brilliant grassroots campaign that was launched, and their strategy was to essentially protest every single shareholder meeting of the company that owned the dams. And that started out as Scottish Power. And so there was a contingent, a delegation of Indigenous peoples that went to Scotland and protested. And they had signs, that said things like dams kill salmon. And the Scottish people, they didn't know. They didn't know. And they love their salmon out there. And so they were like, oh, what the heck? Like, and they ended up selling the project, the Klamath Dams, to PacifiCorp Power. And then when that happened, the movement, as you mentioned, went to every single shareholder meeting of PacifiCorp Power, which is owned by Berkshire Hathaway, which is owned by Warren Buffett, the richest man in the world. And they would go to Omaha, they would go to Portland, they went to Sacramento, all over. And essentially, the strategy was to raise awareness about the harm the dams were causing. And that was I mean, they were fierce about it. So they would do public comment. They would have these huge banners that said things like Warren Buffett kills salmon, or dams equal ecocide, dams equal cultural ecocide, dams take away jobs and our future. And they were just present. They were constantly present and fearful. And eventually they got the attention of PacifiCorp. And right around that time, there was also a special moment where the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission license, so FERC license to operate the Klamath Dams, expired. And this was in 2006. And that gave all the advocates of Klamath Dam removal a legal pathway to advocate for dam removal. So in that proceeding, Yurok, the Kurukh, and some NGOs petitioned for dam removal. And that was unheard of at the time. FERC had never approved a dam removal at that side of that size, and especially at the objections of the power company, which at that point, PacifiCorp petitioned FERC to relicense the dams consistent with the status quo. And these dams were not built with any fish passage. So imagine, Klamath River, third largest salmon-producing river in the whole lower 48 states. The dams were built between 1911 and 1962 without fish passage. And by this time, so about, 2006, 2007, the salmon runs were in severe crisis. We were down to single-digit percentages of the historical salmon runs. And of course, the fish kill had happened. And yet, the power company was petitioning to relicense these dams without any changes at all. And turns out that that was basically illegal. So through a hearing, we were able to put forward the tribe's federally reserved rights. So the Matz versus Arnett case, and then the subsequent line of cases that said Yurok has a federally reserved fishing water right. That means there has to be salmon in the river to catch, and these dams are hurting them. And we coupled those with energy law, environmental law, and we got to a place in the proceeding where we had won on almost every single account. And what that meant was that it was likely for, if FERC was going to relicense the dams, that PacifiCorp would have to install fish mitigation measures, which would be fish ladders. And at that point, PacifiCorp got pretty scared and pressed pause on the hearing. And we did an economic analysis that demonstrated it was cheaper to remove the dams than it was to install fish ladders. And then all of a sudden, we had a common interest with our enemy, right? Where they wanted to save money for their ratepayers, which meant dam removal, and we wanted the dams out to save our river, our fish, and our way of life. So we had this interest, and we entered into a $550 million settlement agreement that equally valued the rights of nature, indigenous peoples, and business. And that's how we got the dams out.
One story just really stands out to me. I think probably others as well. you'd fantasized about, you know, blowing up the dams, right? You didn't. You did it the legal way, but you got to press the detonator. That must have been. Tell me what you're feeling
Oh,
then on one of those
man.
dams.
Tell me, that was a dream come true. I mean, you can only imagine. So I am a fisherwoman. That is what I do. And, you know, as we've talked about, every generation of my family has fished hard day and night for these Klamath River salmon. And we love fishing. We have deep respect for the salmon. And it feeds our family, you know. And so we knew that those dams were a major contributing cause of the demise of the river and a threat to our existence. And so there were so many times when me and other fishing people had sat around the river bar, you know, at fish camp next to a campfire and just daydreamed about blowing up those dams, you know, we several times. And so there I am. It's, you know, the dam removal year. So this was just last year and it's my birthday. And I had a colleague who was, you know, was very in the management of dam removal. And, you know, we'd been talking and he said, well, why don't you come down for to witness a blast of Kopco? It's your birthday, you know, you can come with me. And so we go down there and it's a cold day and the crews had spent all day setting up the dynamite. You know, there's the detonator. And then there's a long stick, a long set of wires that go all the way to the dam. And they had set that up along with, you know, lots of dynamite in different places on the dam. And so we're sitting around there talking, and I'm just so excited to even be there. And then we get close to detonating time, and they look at me and say, do you want to ignite the detonator? And I said, are you asking me to blow up the dam? It was like, yes. And so then I got the instructions of how to do it. And I write about this in the book. And, you know, it was like a 5 minute countdown, a 1 minute countdown. And I'm saying my prayers as much as I can that this is going to go well. And then, you know, there was a 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And I got to yell, fire in the hole. And, you know, and actually, it wasn't like a hand thing. You had to stomp on it. And they told me, you got to do it with force. Like you couldn't be a sissy about it. And so I stomped on that thing with like the force of all those negative feelings of injustice that had been running through 6 generations of the family. So I hit that sucker hard and it was this gigantic explosion. And there were, I mean, just this massive, like, dust cloud with rebar and chunks of steel and concrete, and it's, you know, 100, 200 feet in the air. I mean, it was just remarkable. And then as the dust kind of settled, my colleague yells, happy
An extraordinary experience.
It really was. It really was. So, yeah.
Finally, just have about 2 or 3 minutes left. I want to talk about restoration. Of course, you had to blow up the dams, and the salmon have made a remarkable recovery, but a lot of restoration to go. I was fascinated by the fact that you're planting billions of native seeds. So you're a quote you hear, it's acorns and willows and first foods. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, so dam removal was just the beginning. Through 2028, we are embarked on restoration projects throughout the former hydroelectric project area, but also throughout the whole entire Klamath Basin. So within the rec the excuse me, the hydroelectric project area, we are restoring 20,000 acres, basically like recovering the tributaries to the main stem channel. We are replanting, as you mentioned, 19 billion, already we've done this, 19 billion native seeds within that area, within the what we call the reservoir footprint. And what that will do is recreate a native ecosystem, right? So as much as we can, and of course there will be some invasive species that come in, but we're trying to mitigate that. But that will recreate whole ecosystems that will support all forms of life. Also behind that, within that area, there are cold water springs that will go up and then be able to flow down into the entire Klamath River and make it cleaner and colder. Beyond the dams up the river, there's been huge restoration projects. Agency Barnes is one where we've increased actually sucker habitat. And then we're working with the agricultural districts up there to help them prepare for salmon to return. So getting different fish screens so that salmon go to the places we want them to. And then within those areas, working on restoration projects to rebuild riparian habitat and helping to work on water quality. And the same thing's happening downriver too, where we're engaged in very large riparian area restoration projects. Because it's not just dam removal, it's an opportunity to heal the entire river. One thing I'm really happy about and proud of is that at my nonprofit, the Ridges to Riffles Indigenous Conservation Group, we are helping to facilitate an intertribal advisory group that is basically putting Indigenous leaders and knowledge in the driver's seat of all this restoration work. So that we're using that traditional knowledge about how the basin worked pre-colonization, and then matching that with modern science, and basically use what that means is we're using every tool we have available to rebuild, renew this very beautiful, very large ecosystem in the Klamath Basin. And the results already have been remarkable. The water, the river itself is cleaner and more fierce, colder than I've ever seen it. And the salmon came home faster and in larger numbers than anyone anticipated. So we're really excited.
Great place to end this conversation. Much more in the book. You'll have to go and read it. The book is called The Water Remembers, My Indigenous Family's Fight to Save a River and a Way of Life. We've been talking with the author, Amy Bowers Cordalis. You can find her at amybowerscordalis.com. And you can find out about Ridges to Riffles at ridgestoriffles.org. Amy Bowers Cordalis, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Walk loud.
Okay, thank you. And thanks everybody for listening to Access Utah.